Hello, you're listening to the download of The Business of Film with me, Mark Kermode, from BBC Radio 4.
I sit at the meeting point of art and money. My grandfather was a painter, my father was a painter, but I've been trained as a businessman. The last 3 years I've made 25 films, a movie called Ain't Them Body Saints, All Is Lost, Paperboy, The Butler, Dallas Buyers Club, Blue Valentine. So I'm able to sit there and talk to artists about their work and be able to be realistic with them about what the value of that picture is going to be. Now, that's not based on some wild success of that film. You know, all I'm thinking about is its failure. If it doesn't work...
Cassian Elwes, one of the most highly regarded independent film producers in the business.
The success of a film is whether or not the investors got their money back and made a profit on the film. If the audience really liked the movie as well, that's fantastic.
The film business is strange and unpredictable. The most critically successful films are not necessarily the most profitable films. Last Sunday night, Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman picked up 4 Oscars, including Best Film and Best Director, having taken less than $40 million at the US box office. Meanwhile, the big loser of the night at the Academy Awards was Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, which has so far earned over $300 million in the US alone. How Birdman's recent Oscar win will affect its future profitability remains to be seen, but many of the themes that featured in that film are at the heart of this week's episode. The risk of staging a new project, the lure of the Hollywood franchise formula, the never-ending battle between art and commerce.
There is an audience out there that is underserved by films, that want emotionally engaging, intelligent stories, that don't want to go and see superhero movies.
For producers like Graham Broadbent, the challenge is to create original films which strike a chord at the box office. But just as audiences are unpredictable, so are the vagaries of film financing. As Graham discovered when he tried to get a movie off the ground back in 2008, straight after the financial crash.
So we hopped from financier to financier to financier again. We've got Judi Dench, we've got Maggie Smith. But there was something about the story that just couldn't find a home at that stage. I was sitting in LA with my partner Pete, having a meeting at Fox Searchlight. And on the DVD cabinet of the head of Fox Searchlight at the time was Cocoon 1 and Cocoon 2. And I said to Peter Rice, what is Cocoon doing sitting on your DVD? That doesn't seem like your sort of film. At which point he said, we're convinced there's an older audience out there and they're underserved. I said, don't worry about Cocoon. Put it on one side. I've got something called The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. So that got us to finance.
This unlikely comedy about a group of British retirees who decide to move to India found favour with an older audience who had been poorly served by the blockbuster action-adventure fare which dominated the multiplexes. It went on to be a huge hit, both critical and, perhaps more importantly, commercial.
Our first weekend in the UK was about £2 million. The second weekend was £2.2 million. Now, films, generally, you drop down in your first week to your second week because the people who've been waiting to see it have seen it. What happened for us was that people had found the film, gone to see it, and then told more people to go and see it the second weekend, so suddenly the number's up. A box office of $140 million from a film that cost around $10 or $11 million. What I think audiences can be thirsty for is emotionally engaging characters on real journeys. But maybe particularly for our audience, they suddenly found something in the cinema that they could enjoy and transported them.
Although sequel remains a dirty word in certain sections of the film industry, the success of The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel tempted its creators to come back for more. But could The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which opened in the UK this week, really live up to the original?
Our biggest concern was not to let people down. As filmmakers, the complication and the difficulty is to suddenly go, I mean, we're British, we don't do sequels. We're not in the business of superhero sequels and Marvel sequels.
People have talked about the difference between the British and American film industry being that in America they're looking for franchises, and in Britain we kind of shy away from that? Your first reaction was, we don't do that.
The UK is a cottage industry of people who make bespoke films because they think they might be a businessman, but they love them a little bit more, they care about them that little bit more. We do it a different way here.
Last year, 7 of the 10 highest-grossing movies were sequels, such as Transformers: Age of Extinction, The Hobbit: Battle of the Five Armies, or X-Men: Days of Future Past. For some, these franchises are not just the biggest part of the movie business, they are the movie business.
Hollywood views itself, and don't laugh, but it's in the intellectual property business. It creates a property, and what fascinated me about it is how rational it is.
It's simple. They found a formula that works for them. So just like with any product, can you scale it, and how marketable is it?
About 70% of the market is not in the United States. Korea, Japan, China, Russia. Action drives the film.
It's another spin-off. It's another remake. It's another sequel. They're going to bring all the characters together for the next one. They're going to have them all split up and be in each other's movies. The same movie regurgitated over and over again.
If you have the next Spider-Man coming out, you can put in your budget a roundabout $250, $300 million box office expectation. An original film, there's a huge range in box office expectation. That becomes a lot more unstable, so corporations don't like instability.
Marketing expert Vincent Brucesi, journalist and author Edward J. Epstein, and film financier Cassian Elwes.
The entire business changed in 2008. The financial markets collapsed. The studios, using the Writers Guild strike, totally reassemble the type of film that they want to make.
Don Murphy, producer of the obscenely successful Transformers movies.
It's constantly about trying to mitigate your risk. If you're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars by the time you're done marketing it worldwide, you sure as hell want to be able to turn to your boss if you failed and say, hey, sorry, man, it made sense on paper.
So anything else that seems somewhat original, the studios are absolutely terrified of those films. And what's happened is that the studios have now ceded the quality motion picture business to independent filmmakers.
Last week, we heard how lengthy film development can be, even for the major studios with money to burn. But when it comes to independent productions, raising the financing for a feature can be an adventure all of its own.
If I look at some of the films that I've been involved with recently, Mr. Turner is a film that was largely financed through international pre-sales. A film like The Inbetweeners, Channel 4 just cut a cheque for.
Nick Bauer, previously of Ingenious, whose credits include such pricey blockbuster hits as Avatar, is the co-founder of film finance company Riverstone Pictures.
A small independent film that's recently released, Still Life, which is patched together with money from Italy, from Switzerland, from Germany, from the UK, without the involvement of the BFI or any of the UK broadcasters.
Here in the UK, independent films are frequently financed through the two public service broadcasters, via Film 4 and BBC Films, with additional income being raised through pre-sales and international distribution deals. There's also funding available from the British Film Institute, or BFI. The biggest public funder of films in the UK, the BFI, who allocate funds from the National Lottery, have £6 million of development money and £17 million to fund production. Crucially, a large part of their remit is to develop new talent. Ben Roberts from the BFI.
We're looking for a filmmaker who we feel we are helping, because it's lottery money. Yeah. There is a statistic of production in the UK that 82% of filmmakers who make a feature film don't make another feature film in the next 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So one of our jobs is to focus on those who we think have got careers.
What are the upper end of budgets that you'd be involved in?
Not much over £10 million. £10 million of which we would probably be investing too. And the reason I say that is because they are becoming very commercial propositions.
They have to be.
Once they become commercial propositions, there is generally someone who can pick up the check.
So it sounds to me like what you're doing is a really strange balancing job, which is on the one hand, you can lose a certain amount of money, but on the other hand, you have to do a certain amount of good. Does that not keep you awake at night, balancing those two things?
Well, it should. It actually doesn't keep me awake at night because I've realized that you can only control that to a certain degree.
In terms of the risk and how you mitigate that, in the independent film world, which is most of the British film industry, the risks are mitigated really by spreading them.
David Cossey is head of Film 4. Last year, Film 4's The Inbetweeners 2 broke UK box office records for a comedy by making £2.75 million on its opening day alone.
So if one invests in 10 films, what tends to happen, maybe five of those films break even, two of those films suffer real losses, one or two of those films enjoy significant successes, and one of those films becomes a massive success. And then the game is, how do I take that one winner and not have it just be a one-off?
The hit thing, it's a bit like buying a lottery ticket. You might have a sense of scale and stars, but you can make a lot of movies of scale with stars that do nothing.
Christine Langan is head of BBC Films, the recipients of a special BAFTA award last month, recognising their contribution to British cinema. Since 2009, Langan has been involved in such diverse projects as Made in Dagenham, Saving Mr. Banks, Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, and the hugely successful, if critically panned, Mrs. Brown's Boys, Da Movie.
It's very unpredictable. There are all sorts of things that need to happen for the film to succeed. Your timing, the response of an audience, very sympathetic, clever marketing team, whether you're in conflict with weather or sporting events or the things that will take the attention away.
What sort of budgets do you deal with, and what's the lower end, what's the upper end?
I guess it's anything from just over £1 million, the tiniest films we make, to take something like Saving Mr. Banks, where we develop something that then plugs into a studio model, a film with a budget of $30 million. Probably around the $5 million mark is an average. And then when it climbs to $7-8 million, you know that there are certain things that you're going to need.
Such as?
A sort of limited list of directors who have a kind of the right kind of credibility and international status and success behind them, and cast.
How much does the tax rebate system make a difference to shooting films in the UK?
I don't know how we'd do it without the tax credit.
Really?
Yeah.
Last year, spending on film production in the UK rose 35% to £1.47 billion. A significant chunk of this money came from abroad, with Hollywood studios particularly eager to invest in so-called British productions. The reason for their eagerness? A generous tax credit. Industry expert Stephen Follows.
The UK government wants to support British films, so there's a system by when you finish your film, you can submit your accounts to the HMRC, and they will give you about a fifth of the money you've spent back in cash.
And that doesn't matter whether you're a British production or an American production, it's on the work that you do in the UK.
You have to be officially a British film, but this is becoming a broader and broader category. There's a thing called the cultural test, where you have to get a certain number of points. So you get a few points if your director's British, and you get a few points if your film's in English and things like that. So actually, any time that they say you have to have a British director, there's an asterisk that says they have to be British or from Europe. So you could have a Spanish director, it could be in Italian, it could have a French crew, and you could still be very easily British. So Fast and the Furious 6 is a British film. Very, very hard to make a film in Britain and not be British. But do we care?
I think it's crazy that we subsidise British movies with tax breaks, but we don't get any of that money back, and we're subsidising Hollywood.
Producer director Matthew Vaughan.
We're not an industry where we could be. You know, if they stop the tax break tomorrow, we're gone. If Hollywood doesn't come here, what's left?
The UK is always going to be an attractive place to make a film because we have great crews, and London and other parts of the UK are great places to spend time.
Nick Bauer.
To say also, I think the tax credit is a net income revenue generator for the UK. So if you make Edge of Tomorrow in London and you bring Tom Cruise here and he's paid $20 million, the government is writing a cheque to the studio for 20% of that cost. So they're giving the studio $4 million. But Tom Cruise is paid $20 million in the UK and we withhold tax on his salary at 50%. the Exchequer's just made $10 million.
Why don't we say to the studios, OK, we will do 20%, but once the film's recouped, we want 5% of the film, 10%. It doesn't matter, just a small sum of money. And then if you want 5% of Bond, and then that should be a new film fund that will then do 50% of British films.
Aside from tax credits, a crucial part is played in the financing of your films by the sales agent who sells distribution rights. Films are made by production companies and screened by cinemas, but the two are linked by distributors. Peter Watson, Deputy Chairman of Hanway Films.
The studio model, obviously, and they own and control worldwide distribution. They can fully finance a film, whereas the independent distribution model involves putting in place a patchwork of distribution deals. And this is done by an intermediary, which is the sales agent. And it's they who estimate the prospective value of distribution rights. And these estimates provide a tool for financiers to assess the risks involved in financing films.
What has worked in the past? What was its box office? How did it sell internationally?
Cameron McCracken, Managing Director of Pathé UK.
You then forecast the sort of revenues that this new package is likely to generate.
I mean, there's this terrible, precarious moment that the independent producer has to endure where he says, OK, this film is happening. He has to go out and beg, borrow and steal. He has to call on every favour. Extremely complex to close financings. So there's lots of lawyers, there are lots of documents. If you lose an actor or if there's a wobble somewhere or something fundamental changes, the whole pack of cards can come falling down. But it's terrifying.
Please collect your weapon.
The Call-Up is a sci-fi action movie set in the world of an augmented reality computer game.
Matt Wilkinson is a first-time director. He's just finished financing his debut feature, The Call-Up.
Once you're in the war zone, you can feel pain, and not only can you feel pain, but you can be killed.
And what was raising funding like?
It was complicated. It's referred to as jigsaw financing, and we had a two-minute film to show distributors. That promo was picked up by a sales agent. We then set about trying to find our other pieces of the jigsaw. We spoke to Creative England. They were overseeing two pots of money, a pot that's kind of government's art money, but a pot that's also commercial finance. And this particular remit is the West Midlands Production Fund. But that money had to be match funded. And then we had to look at our shortfall. And then on top of that, we used gap finance to close the gap that enabled us to close our finance and go into production. The challenge, of course, is nobody knows, with any kind of film ever, how it will ultimately appeal.
There are upwards of 700 films released every year in the UK, all vying for audience attention. And while independent filmmaking has always been a tough proposition, Nick Bauer believes that the marketplace is currently more uncertain than ever.
Territories which used to be worth a lot of money are much, much less certain. We had a period when Russia was ascendant. That's kind of immediately reversed again. The potential in China is obviously enormous, but it's a real struggle to work out how to actually capture that. DVD has fallen off a cliff. VOD is growing strongly, but from a tiny base and hasn't yet replaced that. Actually making films and getting them financed is in many ways is harder than ever.
El Mariachi was famously made for $7,000. If you can make a film for that, then why would you spend more? I just sort of reverse engineered that.
Fiercely independent filmmaker Shane Carruth made his feature debut in 2004 with the micro-budget Primer. Made in Texas, Primer became a cult hit after it won a grand jury prize at the Sundance Festival. In the wake of its success, Carruth found himself being lured to L.A., where he hoped to get his ultimately unrealised second feature project, A Topiary, off the ground.
People would say that they were a huge fan of my work, and I would slowly realise that they hadn't actually seen the film. I had it in my head after Primer. I had the ability to go make a movie with real budget, and then started taking meetings on how to make this real and get it financed. Again, I had endless meetings, and everybody's so enthusiastic, and, oh, this is going to be so wonderful, this is going to be so great. But nothing's actually happening. These are just people saying things. And in that time, I came up with this story for Upstream Color. After a while, I realized, well, I've got this story in front of me, Upstream Color, that I really like, and I don't have to ask anybody's permission to go make it. I just stopped going out there to LA and just made the film that I knew I wanted to make.
And how did you finance Upstream Color?
It's me and three friends putting together small sums of money.
So you wrote, directed the film, did the soundtrack, you know, produced, edited, did the cinematography, operated the camera, and also, perhaps most importantly, you were in control of the film being released to theaters. Tell me about that.
Here in the US, I handled the distribution. So I found myself with a film that I owned outright. I've been through distribution. I know how to do the digital side of it. Literally, the only thing stopping me from distributing this myself is just wrapping my head around theatrical distribution. It became a choice between, okay, I can tackle that and try to figure that out, or try to get into a prestigious festival and ask for a deal from one of these distributors that's really just going to do the same thing I'm going to do. So we treated Sundance not as a place to sell a film, but as a place to sell the film to the public. Everything anybody ever heard about that film as far as promotion came from the filmmakers.
Is there any part of you that feels seduced by just signing up to do a production movie because it would line your pockets?
Absolutely, yeah. I think almost daily. It's very exciting to sort of project myself into what that would be like. For me personally, it feels like a very slippery slope, but it's definitely tempting.
Even the most commercial project envisaged by Shane Carruth was not enough for the studios to say yes. Yet Hollywood is alluring, and since the earliest days of Tinseltown, wealthy individuals have been tempted. There's now an ever-replenishing list of investors who are financing some of the best independent films. There's Teddy Schwartzman, who financed The Imitation Game. And there's Megan Ellison, who financed Zero Dark Thirty, American Hustle and Foxcatcher, all of which earned Oscar nominations. The independent film world was very much on display at this year's Academy Awards, the vast majority of Best Picture nominees coming from outside the studio system, including Selma.
Even though it was about Martin Luther King, it's still quite a hard sell.
Cameron McCracken from Pathé UK helped finance Selma, but it was a struggle.
The perceived wisdom is that for a white mainstream audience, there's no interest in narratives which feature black characters driving their own narrative. The huge difference came about a year or so ago when Oprah Winfrey came on board, but it was never straightforward on that one.
Although blockbuster films frequently focus on our greatest fears, advance of technology, global warming, alien invasion, Hollywood's most powerful industry leaders have been slow to respond to a demand for movies that reflect a greater cultural diversity.
I suppose most movies are dominated to a certain extent by male, middle-class, white, heterosexual viewpoint. There's nothing wrong with that viewpoint, but there are more stories to be told than just that.
Hollywood has woken up to the fact that women exist. And if you look at the movies from the 90s, they were mostly targeted towards men. And they have something for the women in it. You know, Con Air has a love story, I guess. It has a teddy bear.
Industry expert Stephen Follows.
So what Hollywood's realised now is that women are independent, they have their own money, they make their own decisions. And so if there's a date, there's far less obligation for the man to pay or for the man to pick. So I had a look at the numbers for the UK film industry and for Hollywood film industry. And in Hollywood, the percentage of women in crews and film crews that are on set is about 22% women. And in the UK, it's about 26% women. The interesting thing was when I did the same analysis for the last 20 years, it's been pretty much static. It hasn't changed by almost a percent.
It is male-dominated. People can say differently, but you just have to look at studies or statistics.
3 years ago, Bruna Papandrea set up a production company with actress Reese Witherspoon and went on to make the Oscar-nominated hits Wild and Gone Girl.
100% our mandate was to start off just developing roles for women.
And did you meet any resistance to that? Is that something that's been embraced?
Reese has spoken about this many times, that she was trying to decide what she was going to act in next, and she went around to all the studios and she said, well, what are you developing for women? And I really don't think there was much there at all. So she knew she had to do something. We just made a movie with Sofia Vergara, who is, I think, considered one of the most popular, you know, people in the Latin-speaking market in America. And there's not a lot of people developing movies for those women.
So when you walk in the door and say, hey, you know, I got this idea for this movie and it's going to star so-and-so and this is the story, and they go, who's going to direct it? Yeah, when I tell them it's a woman, they're like, uh-oh.
In Cassian Elwes's view, buyers who want action films don't see women as action directors, despite the success of filmmakers like Kathryn Bigelow. And with the foreign sales companies providing the pre-sale estimate for the value of a movie, then it's difficult to get that movie financed.
What they want to sell internationally is action movies. I've been thinking about this a lot and been working on an initiative, which I did with the Sundance Institute and Women in Film this year, where we brought a young college-age female director to Sundance and gave her the experience of meeting her peers and being mentored a little bit by myself and two fabulous female producers.
We began this program with the success story that was The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, a film that capitalized upon the patronage of an older audience neglected for years by filmmakers and distributors. In fact, when stories started circulating about viewers bursting into spontaneous applause at the end of the King's speech, many suspected it was because the last time those audience members had been in a cinema, they all stood for the national anthem at the end. So, is The Grey Pound the key to untapped cinematic success? In targeting teen audiences, have filmmakers been missing a trick?
To marketeers, over 55 is one group of people. And as we get the baby boomer generation who are grown up on cinema, they're far more active. So this older audience is going to the cinema more, and they have more money, and they have a clearer sense of who they are and what they want. And so we are having more and more content for this older audience. But Hollywood's only just realised, and it's realised all at once, like it woke from a dream. Their audience has already been there. They're literally sitting in the cinema waiting for a movie that they don't hate as much as the one they saw last year. And so that's fascinating. And then the cinemas will show whatever sells. It seems our audience want to see Hollywood films. About 91% of all the money we spend at the box office goes to the studios. If our audiences have access to these movies, if we have the way of getting them, like The King's Speech, to be disproportionately large compared to the budget, maybe the problem is we're not making films people want to see.
And the movies that people do want to see? Well, last year, Transformers Age of Extinction, the biggest-selling film of 2014, took over $300 million in China alone, more than the film's North American box office gross of $245 million. Don Murphy, producer of the Transformers movies.
I think all of the movies, the ones that work and the ones that don't work as well, have all been a ride.
And this is what we'll be exploring next week in our final episode, The Business of Showing, which investigates how films are sold to the public and the importance of the opening weekend.
Just to open it in the United States, it's going to cost $25 million. Now you see that, you know, if you're a studio and you're going to go to the bat 10 to 15 times in a year, you've got to make sure you're very careful about what you're going to bat with.
Thanks for listening to The Business of Film with me, Mark Kermode, a Hidden Flack production for BBC Radio 4. You can find many other programmes to listen to and download for free at bbc.co.uk/radio4, including the film programme.